Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymyr Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymyrbaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome back to the Big Three, or if you're listening for the first time, welcome. Good to have you with us, or with me here today. My name is Mark. I'm the senior pastor at Guymyr Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we unpack three questions from Sunday's sermon. We have continued our series in Genesis 1 to 11 entitled Origin Story, and we're into the second part of the fall, the judgment scene in which God curses the serpent, predicts pain for the woman in childbearing and curses the ground and then clothes the couple and banishes them from the garden. As has been true through the first couple of weeks of this series, as we've been engaged with the tablets of creation and the fall itself, there were lots of questions. So the questions we're going to be looking at today are these. First of all, if the snake does not represent the devil, then why is it important that Jesus is the one to crush his head? Does the snake represent evil more generally or ... Good question, and one that I think is worth reflecting on again in this entire passage of chapter 2 and 3. Second question, if God made Adam and Eve equally in their vocation, why does God only curse Adam's work on the ground? So we'll have a look at that question and the distinctions made between the first couple and the question more broadly of equality. And then this question, why has this excerpt from the Bible been used by so many preachers to emphasize the hopelessness of the human condition and the burden of sin? Some of this, of course, came out of the particular emphases of the sermon that I preached, talking about the grace that we find in the midst of God's judgment, his willingness to ask questions, all the way through to clothing them and protecting them from the tree of life. That there's this ongoing sense of relationship, that there's this commitment that God expresses, commitment to his own plans and purposes that gives not only the first couple, Adam and Eve, hope for their future east of Eden, but also continues to give us hope in our ongoing struggle in a disrupted and broken up world. So let's dive in, have a crack at these questions. So again, the first question is a little bit like some of the questions we've answered over the last couple of weeks about the genre or the kind of literature that we're engaged with. And it also has to do with the question of biblical theology and systematic theology. So I'll try to unpack those a little bit. If the snake does not represent the devil, then why is it important that Jesus is the one to crush his head? Does the snake represent evil more generally or ... So I think, first of all, as I said both last week and the week before, the emphasis in the Genesis 3 account is on the creatureliness of the serpent. Right? So whatever else the serpent represents, it starts with the creatureliness, right? So it is the serpent was the most crafty of all the wild animals that God had created. That's how the serpent is introduced. The curse is that they are cursed above all wild animals. So again, the emphasis is really on that creatureliness, so that the movement of Adam and Eve, the movement of their disobedience or their transgression, is not from trusting in God to trusting in the devil, right? It's not a move from one supernatural entity to another supernatural entity. I think I mentioned this last week. I mean, who could blame them if they had been tempted by the devil? But there's a move from the creator to the creation itself. That seems to be the emphasis in the way the story's told. But that's what we're dealing with. However, because the serpent as a symbol in the ancient Near East, and, you know, shows up in all sorts of places, from the headdresses of pharaohs, where it's that the hooded cobra, seemingly a sign of either protection or of the fact that the pharaohs had the power over life and death, which are two symbols that the serpent represents, or more broadly, that wisdom literature, you know, the wisdom component of the serpent. The serpent symbolizes, shall we say, the desire or the quest to find wisdom, right, or to find control of life and death, or to protect themselves, but within the creation itself, apart from God. So while the story, I think, focuses on the creatureliness of the serpent, there is an element where the serpent more generally represents, I'm not sure I'd say evil, but represents the turning away of the first couple, and shall we say, of all humanity, from God to the creation. Away from God to kind of anything and anyone else, usually including, you know, ourselves, like we'll figure this whole thing out. So I think that that's the move that we find within the text itself. And in that sense then, right, when we apply, I guess, a systematic approach to this passage, and we think more broadly about what the Bible has to say about the disruption of sin and the consequences of this choice that Adam and Eve made, that's when we see the full impact, right? That's when we see the full impact of sin. And in that context, right, then Jesus becomes the one who ultimately defeats sin and death. Now, we don't, that's not really clear for us, shall we say, in the story until we get to, well, I don't know, Romans maybe, right? After the gospel accounts, and then the early Christians begin to reflect upon and apply the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus to the various circumstances, right? So it eventually becomes clear for us in the story. So then when we think, so Jesus is the one who ultimately has undone sin, right? Has undone sin and death and the consequences, and has sent the Holy Spirit to enable the renewal of all things, right? According to the will of the Father. Then we can come back to this passage where it says that the offspring of the woman, right? Which is, again, as I said, I reckon Adam and Eve probably thought Cain, possibly Abel, maybe Seth, may have been the offspring, like that, the very near horizon. But we look at the fact that Jesus was fully human as shall we say, an offspring of the woman, and that he ultimately undid what began with the serpent's temptation. So I'm not sure if that helps make sense of it. I think what I'm trying to get at is we see Jesus as the fulfillment of Genesis 3:15 in the light of what happens in the New Testament. It's not clear in Genesis 3:15 who it's talking about. It doesn't become clear until much, much later on. And then the parallel is not precise, right? But we certainly see what scholars call a deeper meaning, like a second meaning to that text, that there is someone who has come from the line of the woman and has undone the impact of what the serpent has done. So I hope that makes some sense. I feel like I was a little bit clouded in terms of my logic there, but hopefully that makes some sense. So in essence, the serpent, I think, does represent something more than just the creature, but even the wisdom, the life, the death, the protection, like all the stuff it symbolizes, is still focused away from God, not towards another God, but towards the earth, right? Towards something that has been created. And I think in that sense, ultimately Jesus undoes that the impact of that turn away and enables us to once again turn to God in the fullness of time. The second question wraps around the differences in the judgments on the woman and the man, and really also raises the question of how we read the first and the second tablet of creation together. I mentioned when we looked at the second tablet in chapter 2 that the two creation accounts are meant to be read together. They're meant to inform each other, but we're not trying to harmonize them. In other words, we're not trying to jam them together and make them one comprehensive story that all tells the exact same thing. They're two stories that reflect on two different aspects of even God's character, of his plans and purposes, and in particularly in the creation of humanity. So let me read the question again. If God made Adam and Eve equally in their vocation, why does God only curse Adam's work on the ground? So again, reading the two stories together, in the first tablet of creation, the 7-day account, all we're told about the creation of humanity is that God created them, male and female. He created them in his image. He created them. Like that's the whole story. We're not told that there was, you know, just one couple. Like I read it as the possibility that God created lots of people, I suppose. Of course, the text doesn't care to tell us really too much, right? But everything else has been in multiples. Like he's filled the sea, he's filled the sky, he's filled the land. So he makes humanity. But the emphasis is on their, not on their divinity, because we don't believe that humans are divine, but the emphasis is on being image bearers. That's the emphasis. In the second tablet, the emphasis is on their, on their creatureliness a little bit, right? The idea that Adam is formed from the dirt, and that the woman is taken from the man's side. Like that's a very different kind of creation story, which indicates, and I think we need to read those two together, right? That even though Adam in the second story is formed from the ground and Eve from his side, we're to recognize that they were, that they were still created in the image of God. Even though in chapter 2, the image language is not used for us, is not used to describe them, but I think we read them together. So I think we start from the perspective that men and women, male and female, are equal. Equal in dignity, equal in respect. And they are both given the creation mandate to be fruitful, to multiply, where they obviously have slightly different roles in that, but also to have dominion over everything that God has created, to continue to be his stewards. In chapter 2, in chapter 2, we still have that same emphasis, right? There's an equality about them. There's a difference in how they've been created, but there is an equality to them, and they are both placed in the garden, we believe, to do the same work, right? To care for and work the garden, to extend the reign and rule of God. But it's important to note, as we read these stories, particularly in chapters 2 and 3, that there is a distinction made between the man and the woman, right? In the first account, it's they were made in the image of God. There's no difference, right? God doesn't make men in his image and then make women in his image. He made the male and female in his image. Like that's all we're told. In the second account, the man is formed from the dust. God breathes into him. He becomes a living being. He's placed in the garden. There's not a fit companion. God makes a fit companion, right? There's this kind of marriage scene, right? There's a distinction drawn between them. And I think ultimately that's why when it comes to the judgment scene, that there is also a difference then in the consequences of their actions. For the woman in particular, you know, wrapped around childbearing, the role that women have in the fruitfulness and multiplication on the earth. And for Adam, the role in terms of working the ground. So I don't think that we should see that division of labor as any indication of an inequality of capacity or competence or those sorts of things, but just the distinctions between them, right? So if I can, you know, put it this way, the Lord wouldn't have said to Adam, your pains in childbirth are going to increase. Like that's Well, it's just not the way it works, right? So there is a sense, I think, that there is a distinction between the man and the woman, the man and his wife, I should say, in this context, because I think that context also plays into the role of, you know, childbearing and whatnot, that this is the marriage relationship, not all men and all women. So I think that the way in which the story is told in connection with the first account of creation affirms for us the equality, but that there is also a distinction between them. Now, I think what's also really helpful to remember, and again, we keep coming back to this biblical and systematic theology, when we think about sin across Scripture, there is no sense that men and women are differently sinful in the sense of that, you know, there's a uniquely feminine kind of sin and a uniquely masculine kind of sin, that there's two categories or, you know, two sets of characteristics. There's no sense that sin is gendered in the rest of the Bible. Right? All sins seem to be, they seem to be equal opportunity sins, right? Like, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, you can be greedy and envious and angry and lustful and lazy and like the whole thing, right? Like that there's no gendered nature to that. Nor is there any, gendered salvation. Those who place their faith in Jesus are saved. That male or female, as you know, Paul would go on to say, you know, Jew or Gentile, rich or poor, like those distinctions which mattered so much in society don't matter in the big picture. And I think that's probably also a little bit at work here. There's something unique about the way this story is told with the two acts of creation and then the two statements of judgment that does need to be read in light of the wider teaching of Scripture around the disruption of sin and the consequences of sin that are felt, well, in every corner and pocket of our lives. And there is a frustration in work, and there is a multiplication of pain and childbearing, which are in the story, shall we say, apt to the characters within that marriage situation in the garden, but which are not really carried on, right? We don't get the sense that there's kind of a woman's track and a men's track of sin. It's just, it's all bad for everybody all the time, is probably the better way to look at it. And that, I think, well, at least I hope, will lead into our third and final question today. I mentioned on Sunday that the tension in the story of the Bible, the tension that drives the narrative forward, the question that begs to be answered is not precisely the question of sin. The Bible is not a story about sin. It's a story about how God will overcome sin. And I drew the analogy with like a murder mystery. A murder mystery is about how a murder was solved. It's not about murder. Murder is part of the story, but that's not what the story is about. It's about the solution. It's about solving. It's about untangling all the clues and figuring out who done it. And I think that's a really important reflection on the Bible as a whole, right? It's a story of how God is undoing sin, not just a story about human failure, because that just makes it about us. And the book is not about us, it's about God. So this last question kind of touches on that a little bit. Why has this excerpt from the Bible been used by so many preachers to emphasize the hopelessness of the human condition and the burden of sin? And I'd have a couple of answers to this. The first is, I think, I think we apply our systematic theology to these sorts of texts. And again, I keep coming back to this, but a biblical theology, which when I first heard it, it sounded really like self-righteous, you know, well, you practice, you know, systematic theology. I have a biblical theology. But biblical theology is really a theological method that by and large pays attention to how a theme or a concept unfolds in the story. So, from a biblical theology perspective, what we learn about sin in chapter 3 is actually pretty limited, right? It's pretty limited. We have hints that there's a disruption in their relationship with God, but there's still a relationship with God. He still speaks with them. He still clothes them. There still seems to be connection. But there is disruption. They were fearful of him in the garden, and they're cut off from the tree of life. There's a disruption in their relationship as they blame one another. There's the judgments on, as we talked about in the second question, on the work on the soil and in childbearing. There are other consequences that fall within that. But we don't actually, at this point, in terms of how sin has been introduced in the story, we don't yet know the full impact and extent of it. Chapter 4, which we'll be looking at this coming week, with the story of Cain and Abel, things escalate really quickly, right? And the kind of the next example of sin is fratricide, which you'd have to say is a big step up from what we experience in chapter 3. So biblical theology, I think paying attention to how this story unfolds kind of looks at chapter 3 and goes, okay, there's a disruption here in their relationship with the earth and with one another and with God. And the consequences are pretty bad given what they've fallen from, but they're not as bad as they might have been. There's still grace. There's God's commitment to this. Okay. What I think we tend to do, and I think this is ultimately the answer to the question, is that we apply the truths of systematic theology, right? Where, you know, it's the methodology where you pull everything that the Bible has to say about sin, for instance, out. You pull it all out and then you organize it. And when you pull everything that the Bible has to say about sin out, you end up with a much fuller picture than we are given in chapter 3, right? So we see much more clearly in the rest of the Bible how sin and death are connected, right? We don't see that connection so much in chapter 3, as I pointed out. I mean, Adam does die, right? But age 930, like it's a suspended sentence at best. And that's a long, long time. There's no indicator, for instance, about what we might term spiritual death, right? It's not talked about. It's not described. We don't see that. But by the end of the story, right, and when we get to the end of the book, right, the entire Bible, we just get this much darker, fuller, expansive picture of sin. And then I think what we tend to do is we take our systematic theology, the everything, the full picture, and we place it on top of this story. Like, this is the place where it all began, and so this is where all that stuff starts. So I think sometimes applying systematic theology to a biblical theological methodology can create that tension. I suppose there's some value in that, in the sense that we believe that our systematic theology, like what the Bible has to say about sin or about salvation and redemption and about humanity and whatnot, is reflected in these passages. But I do believe that there's value in at least being aware of what is known or what could be known at this point in the story in chapter 3. But I think that's one of the reasons why this happens. I think another reason why preachers can often focus on this passage in terms of its hopelessness, right, and the burden of sin, is kind of related, and that is that, you know, while the Old Testament hardly talks about the Garden of Eden again, there are a number of places in the New Testament where these passages are spoken about in kind of foundational story ways. You know, Paul kind of famously makes some reference to the temptation of Eve and how she was tempted first and kind of builds a bit of a case around that. Jesus refers to these passages as the basis for marriage and that divorce is just not on. And like, so there's some really, there are places where Jesus and Paul place a great deal of emphasis on these texts. And so I think that, you know, shall we say, justifies our placing emphasis on these passages. I think a third reason is maybe a little bit more historical. Evangelicals as a whole, and you know, that's not a denomination per se. It's you will find evangelicals across lots and lots and lots of different denominations. But it emphasizes, you know, desire to share the good news. It tends to be a little bit activist in its expression of faith. You know, Bible and prayer are really important. Personally, evangelism is really important. We want to see people come to a saving knowledge of Jesus. And for quite a long time, the start of that story, the beginning of the story that leads to salvation, is that we are sinners. And so there has been, I think, I'm not sure it's an unhealthy emphasis, but there's been a really strong emphasis on how sinful we are, that we're beyond our own help. We need Jesus to help us in his death and resurrection. He has helped us. Place your faith in him and you're forgiven and all those sorts of things. And because that simple story, and it's a good story. It's one that we've taken a long time to develop, and it's grounded in what we believe about Jesus. But I think that sin first story means that whenever there's, you know, this opportunity to talk about the failure of humanity to trust God or to obey him or to live within his boundaries, we kind of jump all over it as evidence of the first part of the story, right? That we're all sinners and we need Jesus. Broadly, of course, that's very true. Part of the reason why I've chosen to do this series, though, is because I think there is a movement of God afoot in our society. There are hints of it that people are experiencing a greater openness to faith conversations, to spirituality, and to Christianity in particular. I've preached on this a couple of times. The Encounter series that we did in term two is kind of built on this same idea, that there is a greater openness. The difficulty, though, one of the characteristics, though, of what I'm hearing from colleagues in ministry is that people are coming to faith and coming back to the church in very, very different ways than perhaps they ever have. They're coming from all sorts of different directions. And they're not, shall we say, starting on the path of I'm a sinner. You know, and that's a path that we've worked out. It's a good path. It's one that I think we want people to, you know, largely we want them to be aware of as they move closer to Jesus. But if I can use the path analogy, it's like people are coming across the lawn, and they're not coming to the start of the path. They're entering halfway through. They're finding out about Jesus's teachings, or they're thinking about the connection with the church, which is much later in the story. And that's where they start, and it's a community, or it's a moral framework, or an ethical framework, or whatever. It's just people are coming randomly, and I think the challenge for the church right now is to have to allow a longer runway to Jesus, to allow people to ask more questions, to start in stranger locations, to do it out of order, so to speak, and figure things out in a different way. And that we have to trust that God's at work in their lives and that he's going to bring them to a point of faith. It might look a little bit different than it has in the past for us. And so the idea of looking at these origin stories is to try to give us the broadest picture possible of our story. And I'm not talking about just the church. I'm talking about all humanity. We believe that all humanity, even if they have no understanding or desire for Jesus, we believe that they've been created in the image of God, that they were created with a vocation in mind to continue the work of God in the world, that they have been created to not work all the time, and to give form to that which is formless and fill that which is empty, and bring God's order to the world, ultimately for his glory. That's what we believe about every single human being, and that has been broken up, disrupted by our cumulative and corporate and individual decisions to turn away from God and trusting him and his boundaries and his permission and his vocation to trying to figure it out on our own. That's the story. Like, that's why we think the world's a mess. And yes, that includes the power of sin, as we'll see, but it's that broad, broad story to say, this is where the story begins. This is where the story begins. And I'm hoping that it will function a little bit like that long runway, even for us as Christians, that we might recognize and appreciate the long runway to Jesus. The idea that the story that ends with Jesus began a long time before in a garden. It began with a man named Abram, who God makes extraordinary promises to because of his commitment to saving and renewing the world and of reestablishing and removing the disruption and reestablishing the relationships. Recognizing that long story, I think, then helps us meet people as they cross the lawn towards the path to faith. And I may be mixing too many metaphors here. But I think that this idea of, you know, of just allowing the story to speak without bringing all of our systematic truths back into it, without simplifying the story, well, there's a time and a place for that, but without simplifying the story and just making it all about you're a sinner and put your faith in Jesus and here's the prayer, like just expanding that story out, being more patient, giving people more time, I think there's something really incredibly valuable about it. And so as we're looking at these stories, I've been trying to hold that tension for us a little bit, to say, hear the stories as they sit, as they reflect, and as they speak to humanity as a whole, and the way in which they position us in the world. And so I hope that pulls the curtain back a little bit in terms of what it is that we're trying to accomplish in this series and why I keep focusing so strongly on this is what we know in the story at this point in time. This is what we don't yet know. This is what we do. You know, the creatureliness of the serpent rather than pitching it as the devil, right? Just let the story speak and allow that long runway to Jesus to really play itself out and allow us to find ourselves in it. So thank you again for those of you asked those questions. There were a number that I obviously did not get to today. This coming week, we're looking at Cain and Abel. It's basically the story of Cain. Abel plays a very, very bit role in it, never says a word. He's there and then he is gone. But looking at that story as an extension of the failure in the garden and what that ends up meaning for us as a community of faith and for that long runway to Jesus, the big, big story, the origin story that we believe applies to all. So I hope that you can join me on Sunday, either on site or online. And until next week, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big 3 podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.